Now, government spending is a hot-button issue on both sides of the political aisle, between complaints that certain agencies are more well-funded than others and worries that the federal debt is getting out of hand. Anytime government spending is investigated, tensions are bound to be high.
That was the case this week when a Washington Post investigation showed that the Pentagon allegedly buried a report that showed that the Department of Defense could reduce unnecessary spending by upwards of $125 billion.
Craig Whitlock joins us now. He's an investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He broke that story along with Bob Woodward. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Start off by telling us about this report, trying to reduce spending waste. What was the original goal? What was the origin story here?
The original goal of this study was that senior leaders at the Pentagon said they wanted to find efficiencies in their business operations. You know, the Pentagon's one of the largest organizations of any kind in the world, and they regularly come under scrutiny for how they spend their taxpayer dollars. And they were under some pressure the last few years from Congress on the defense budget, so they were looking for some ways to save money in the bureaucratic back office. So they asked an advisory panel of private sector experts to really dive into that and see what they could do.
And this isn't the first time this kind of report has happened over the years, is it?
No, the Pentagon constantly has been getting scrutiny along these lines because, as you know, it's grown and grown and grown since the end of World War II, and certainly they have a very large mission to provide for national defense and military operations around the world. But again, in this particular study, they wanted to take a look at not at weapon systems, not at troops, but at the cost of business operations. And these are things like, you know, human resource management or real estate procurement, things like that, the kind of things you need to oil any organization. But the question is, how much does the Pentagon have, and do they need to spend that much?
And what were the findings of this report? Where did they find room for improvement?
Well, the Pentagon, the report surprised senior leaders at the Pentagon because it found that they were spending far, far more, perhaps 50% more on these business operations than they thought. What they were able to do for the first time was gather data from all these different arms of the Defense Department that for the first time showed exactly how many people were working in these, what they call these core business operations, essentially administrative overhead jobs. And what they found was that just over 1 million people were employed in these positions. And this was a mix of civilians who are federal civil servants, a mix of troops who were doing desk work, and above all, defense contractors. So to give you some context for that, the Defense Department only has 1.3 million active duty troops, and yet there's a similar army, so to speak, of 1 million people working in business jobs. So the ratio there is a little bit out of whack.
And as you report, this information came out and was not released to the public. It seems like you're writing there's an effort to suppress this in a way.
Well, sort of. Let me correct you on that. The report itself, the summary, it was made public. The data behind it showing where all these people worked and you know, the details of how the money was being spent, that was classified, that was kept secret, and that still has not been released. And as we reported, that while the report was briefly made public and voted on in public session by this advisory panel, you know, afterward it was removed from a public website where these kind of reports are kept. And there was also an effort within the Pentagon to silence any sort of public debate over it. The Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, made some allusions to this in a speech he gave at a think tank in Washington. He was complaining about all the money that Pentagon was wasting on overhead and bureaucracy when he needs, you know, he's scraping for money to build more warships. And the next morning, he got some nasty emails from the Pentagon's chief weapons buyer, Frank Kendall, and from the deputy defense secretary, the number two guy at the Pentagon, Robert Work, telling him to, you know, button it up, that they didn't want a public discussion about this. The irony of this is that, of course, Robert Work, the number two guy at the Pentagon, was the fellow who commissioned this study to begin with and had publicly touted how they were going to use it to save all this money. But after the results came out, he changed his position and decided it wasn't worth pursuing.
And what were the reasons for not pursuing the recommendations of this report and, as you say, taking it back off the website and trying to keep a low profile there?
Well, so in our interview with Robert Werk and with some other senior Pentagon officials, they said that the study really wasn't practical in its recommendations. They did not dispute any of the numbers, but they said expecting that a public agency, particularly a government agency as large as the Pentagon, to streamline itself that quickly to save $125 billion over 5 years, which is what the study was calling for, they said that wasn't realistic. They say it's one thing to you know, change jobs and operations that quickly if you're a corporation, but it's much harder if you're a government agency. And one example they give of that is they say Congress doesn't like it when the Pentagon reduces the number of defense jobs because that means fewer jobs in lawmakers' districts. So that was really the reasons they gave to us. Now, they did acknowledge that from a political perspective, they were worried how Congress would react, that for the last few years, defense leaders and military leaders have been testifying on Capitol Hill that they needed more money, that the defense budget was too tight, that this was affecting their ability to train and equip the troops. And they had been complaining about this quite loudly. So now they were worried that if Congress really got wind of a study that found that the Pentagon was wasting $125 billion over 5 years on administrative overhead, that Congress would use as an excuse to cut their budget, and they would say, well, you don't need more money, you need less money. And so that was a very real concern on their part.
Talking to Craig Whitlock from The Washington Post, talking about a report on potential cost savings for the Pentagon, not in frontline troops, but in back-end administrative management sort of positions. Craig, Congress has gotten wind of this report now since your piece came out. Are we seeing reaction in Congress to what's going on here?
Yeah, so I think we've seen a pretty strong reaction from members of both parties. The chairman of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees have called on the Pentagon to release the data behind this report, all the data showing where all these millions of people, or 1 million people, are employed and how much they cost. They're asking the Pentagon to finally release that data that's been kept secret. And others have said that, you know, this is a prime example of the kind of thing that the new Congress and the new president-elect, Donald Trump, when they talk about cutting defense waste, this is a place they should look.
Yeah, we've heard Ron Kine, congressman from Wisconsin, since this has called for investigations. He's been calling for some kind of changes at the Pentagon as well. You said Republicans as well, though, are climbing on board here.
Yes, it seems to certainly be on a bipartisan basis that lawmakers are pretty concerned about this. Now, of course, again, there's been, as you point out, there's been studies all over the place for many years spotlighting, you know, inefficiencies and waste at the Pentagon and just how much they spend. You know, we all remember the stories of, you know, $500 toilet seats and you know, $1 billion fighter jets and things like this. But what was different about this study is that, again, as we discussed in the beginning, the Pentagon leadership itself had asked to do this study. They had set it up. They asked these private sector leaders to come in, and they touted this. They said, this is a good approach. We're going to have these outsiders come in and show us how to do things differently and how we can save some money, and we're serious about it this time. But still, when the results came out, they were bigger and worse than they expected. So that's when they changed their tune on it and said this was impractical and unfeasible, and we don't want to talk about it anymore.
House Speaker Paul Ryan was on our show earlier this week. Among other budget priorities, he talked about wanting to restore funding to the military, worried about a hollowed out military. Does this information make that case harder to make to Congress?
Well, actually, I think in some ways it makes it easier. And in fact, the way this study was written, the Defense Business Board, which was the advisory panel that produced it, they were saying, look, you can save $125 billion over 5 years by cutting back the bureaucracy, but our recommendation is you spend that on things the troops really need, like warships, like army brigades. You know, they said, you know, that amount of money would cover the operating costs of 50 army brigades, you know, or 10 aircraft carrier battle groups, or, you know, a couple thousand fighter jets. You know, so that's in response to those concerns, like Congressman Ryan was talking about, with a hollowed out force. the argument here is the Pentagon should streamline its bureaucracy. They don't need to spend so much money on that, and instead use that those savings for the warfighter.
At some point in your piece, somebody references kind of a "this too shall pass" attitude in the Defense Department. We've seen it before. People trying to reform, the attitude would go, "We'll wait it out and be okay." Is there a sense that maybe this time that won't be true? That some kind of reforms, now that this is out here, might be necessary?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the jury's still out on that. But again, we have a new president coming into the White House who's going to have a Republican Congress. So, you know, the stars are aligned where I think things are going to happen in Washington. We aren't going to have government divided on a party basis. But I don't think it's that simple. I mean, you know, reforming the Pentagon is tough. And as you pointed out, there were some pretty candid memos that we were able to report on saying that, you know, the bureaucracy knows that it can often dig in its heels and wait things out. But, you know, so it's going to take some determination on the part of President-elect Trump and Congress to make some, you know, enduring changes. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think it's a new day here in Washington, and we'll see what happens.
A lot of key Trump advisors are going to have the title general in front of their names, a Homeland Security, Department of Defense, National Security Advisor, as currently planned anyway. Does that help or hinder efforts to reform, do you think?
You know, that's a really good question. General James Mattis, who's a retired four-star Marine general, has been nominated to be Secretary of Defense, and you know certainly he'll have a pretty good handle on how things work at the Pentagon. Michael Flynn, who's the pick to be the National Security Advisor, you know, is a three-star Army general, and yesterday Marine General John Kelly was nominated to be Homeland Security Secretary. So these are all people who have spent their whole careers, for the most part, in the Defense Department. They know how things work. But, you know, that's sort of a double-edged sword. You know, they're from within the system, but they also know where all the bodies are buried. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thank you.
That was Craig Whitlock. He joins us to talk about the alleged $125 billion in bureaucratic waste at the Pentagon. He's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, which broke the story this week.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Recent data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development showed that homelessness in Wisconsin dropped by about 6%. That's double the national drop in homelessness. But though that sounds like good news for the whole state, not every part of Wisconsin has seen that decrease.
Shelters in northwestern Wisconsin, for example, are actually seeing the number of people that are homeless rise. Duana Bremer is Social Service Director for the Salvation Army in Polk, Burnett, and St. Croix counties. Duana, welcome to Central Time.
I am happy to be here.
Well, Duana, first off, start by describing what you're seeing in those counties that you serve, Polk, Burnett, and St. Croix. What's happening there?
Well, especially in St. Croix County, we are seeing a huge increase in the homeless population. And the information is basically in 2014, which is a couple years ago, Grace Place Shelter was able to house approximately 24 individuals. That year, we turned away 129 families just because we did not have space. So 2 years ago, we moved to our new facility. And now, compared to in 2014, we were serving 98 single individuals. This year, we served 148. We also served 105 families compared to 40. And I think what we're seeing is in rural areas, homelessness looks a little bit different than it does in the city. For instance, you don't see the people in rural areas standing there holding a sign saying, "I'll work for shelter." That's more common in urban areas.
What do you see?
The folks are hidden. They're in campers, they're in cars, they're doubled and tripled up. So that look is a little different. Some of the issues we have, though, we are seeing are the same. For example, we're seeing issues with mental health and not enough service providers. One obstacle also in rural areas is the lack of public transportation. If individuals don't have a vehicle, it makes it extremely difficult for them to get around.
I want to back up a little. You talked about the gap between the amount of beds or places you had for people and families and the number you had. So there was a number of families who were turned away there. What happens to those families when they can't find shelter and help from you?
They would either go to a campground, possibly. They might be staying in their car. They might be doubling or tripling up with friends, meaning they're staying with one friend for a couple nights and then move to another friend. And I can give you a really good example of that. We had a family. It was mom, dad, and three children. And they had rented property for many, many years, for about 7 years. And the landlord sold the property, which landlords can do that. It's their property. It was a quick sale, and they were asked to be out of their property within a three-week period. They could not find anywhere to go. So they packed up as much as they could. They put it in their two cars. Mom and dad were both working. They moved to one of the local motels. They were there for a week, and Dad lost his job. At that point, they could not afford to stay at the motel any longer, so they pulled their cars into the Walmart parking lot. And they had all their belongings in the car, so there was not enough room for the family to sleep at one time. So half the family walked around Walmart for 4 hours while the other half of the family slept. And actually, coincidentally, one of the salespeople at Walmart directed them to Grace Place. And we were able to provide them shelter. They actually stayed with us for probably only a 3 or 4 week period and then moved into permanent housing. So sometimes, like that example, it's just a bump in the road. And it's a circumstance that happens that's beyond the control of the individual.
What do you think is going on that we're seeing this spike in homelessness in rural areas, but not as much in urban parts of the state?
Well, I think one of the major things, outside of the fact of the lack of public transportation, it's the lack of low-income housing. Salaries are so low in our area that folks are unable to afford housing, and there is not enough subsidized housing available. So, for example, in St. Croix County, for a family that has one adult and two children, the self-sufficiency wage would be $31.03 an hour. That means that's coming into that family to support them. And to be real honest, in our rural areas, you're lucky to find a job that pays higher than $12 an hour. So that's a huge problem. You know, the folks that live here, housing is just unaffordable.
Is there help for families and individuals who are homeless with finding a job if they're out of work, matching them up with career counseling, that kind of thing?
Well, the shelters that I direct are all self-sufficiency programs. So we work with the individual, providing them case management. We will work with them to help them seek gainful employment. Sometimes that also means going to a WITC, maybe to be a nursing assistant or further their education for a short-term course. We also work with the individuals to help them find suitable housing. There are some programs that are available also, one called Rapid Rehousing that does provide financial assistance to individuals that are moving out of a shelter just to give them a little bit of financial boost for a short time as soon as they leave the facility. Our facilities also have a huge tutoring program for children. Probably about 95% of every child that is homeless as a child will be homeless sometime in their adult life. And we wanted to do something that would help prevent that. And one of the major things that we could offer would be education. So we have a tutoring program that's offered 3 days a week. Retired teachers come in and work with the kids. Most of the homeless kids are about a year and a half behind in school. And by the time they leave our shelter, they have improved by at least 6 months.
Sure, go ahead.
So that's one of the major programs that we provide, hopefully to, you know, change the dynamics of some of the families that are living in poverty.
Can you talk about some of the challenges to education, some of the things that might happen when a family is homeless, maybe homeless for a different stretches of time in and out as they go through the years.
That is very challenging for the children. Now, because of the McKinney-Vento Act, children that become homeless, for instance, in one school district and then have to move to another school district to move into a shelter. So, for example, we're located in New Richmond. If the child became homeless in Hudson, the McKinney-Vento Act requires the schools to provide transportation taking that child back to the school of origin. Because in many cases, the school is the only thing that child has had that's been constant. And every time a child moves to a different school, they lose academic performance. So we work very closely with the schools in our community to be able to assure that all the children are going to the appropriate school in the area that they were residing. We also, in our tutoring program, because many of the parents we work with, education was something that was very difficult for them. They had a very hard time and a hard time in school themselves. So even for them, thinking about going in for a school conference, calling a teacher, that's a very scary thing for those parents. So while they're in our facility, we have tutors that do go with them to the school. They can meet with the counselors to discuss an independent education plan. Because, like I said, the parents, they love their kids, and they want their children to do well in school, but those old memories come back for them.
Is there advice that you have for people who know someone who is homeless and want to get them help, or how to recognize someone who may be struggling with homelessness, or someone who's listening right now who's not sure what steps to take to get help that they need?
They can go online to the Wisconsin Balance of State website, and in that website there is a list of shelters that are available in a variety of areas. They would certainly be able to call our shelter facility, Grace Place, at 715-246-1222, and we could provide a referral to a shelter that is close to an area where they're residing now.
Now, sometimes it can seem that the rural portions of the state take second seat to the big cities and the problems that sometimes come with the more populous areas of the state. What do you want people to know about the needs of rural Wisconsin, especially as it relates to the rise in homelessness that you're seeing there?
Well, I think in our area, you're right. It does appear to say that folks focus more on urban areas. And I think because of rural areas, homeless, like I said, you don't see it, so you don't think it exists. It's not kind of out in front of your face. And I do have to share a little story. I've been involved with the homeless population for about 13 years. And the last Wednesday in July and the last Wednesday in January, the homeless people are counted, which means folks that are counted that are actually residing on the streets. And to be honest with you, for 13 years, I've counted and I have never found anyone on the street until this last year. And in Polk and St. Croix County, there were 7 people that were not in shelter. And I know a lot of times people think, well, it's summer, it's nice out, but there's a lot of mosquitoes in the summer. There's a lot of insects. So summer is just as uncomfortable to stay outside as it is in the winter.
Duana, as we wrap up now, a lot of people this time of year are thinking about how they can help in their communities. So how can people donate or get involved?
If they would like to even contact a shelter in your area and volunteer, bring in a donation. Shelters are always needing supplies, just like any household does. But get involved in your community, because I think a lot of folks look at homeless folks as people that are icky, that you don't want to be around, that you don't want to see. But the thing is, they're people like you and I. And when you think about it, how many paychecks are each of us away from being homeless?
Duana, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Duana Bremer. She's the Social Service Director for the Salvation Army in Polk, Burnett, and St. Croix counties.